That's right. Those of us have been married a long, long time.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. We have a full agenda today, so we'll get rolling right away. I'm going to start off. Do we have Bill's introduction? Okay. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 900, Senate Bill 823, and House Bill 2527. These are all pertaining to the same thing, tax credit for affordable housing lenders. And most of the people who signed up for Senate Bill 900, but you can, when you testify, you can address any of the bills. So, Chris.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As you indicated, the three bills are identical, and they extend the sunset date for the affordable Oregon Affordable Housing Lenders Credit from January 1, 2014 to January 1, 2020.
Okay. We're going to start out with a panel. Let's see. Janet Byrd, Bill Van Vliet, and Martha McLennan.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janet Byrd, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and I'm the Chair of the Housing Alliance. The Housing Alliance is a statewide coalition of about 70 organizations, and you'll, I think you got our materials electronically. You can see the list of our member organizations on our letterhead. The Housing Alliance came together as a coalition out of a concern for the immense housing needs that we see in communities across the state of Oregon. And we're concerned about housing because of the foundation that it provides for families and opportunity in communities. And we know that we all benefit when we and our neighbors have access to that opportunity. We feel really strongly that the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is an essential tool. You'll notice there are three identical bills that extend the sunset on the OHTC. It's a little indication of just how important we think it is. We wanted to be sure we had lots of vehicles to move the extension. The bills would extend the sunset for 6 years. We're not asking for any change to the cap. The sunset currently expires in 2014. This was brought up for consideration this year just to give us enough time to keep projects in the development pipeline. So it has no fiscal impact in the upcoming biennium, but would have impact in later years. So we have a panel that's going to describe the mechanics of how the tax credit works and how the benefits flow through. I just want to make a couple points before we start into those details. Nearly all of the households that benefit from this tax credit are folks who make less than half of the area median income. We provided some charts of county need for housing for some sample counties that are part of the packet. What we know from those charts and from talking to people in the communities is that incomes just don't go far enough to pay for housing. And we're talking about people who really make very little money. Just as an example, for a family of four in Salem, the target population for this credit, folks that a family of four that earns less than half of median income, that's about $28,850 a year. So, you know, folks that really, if we talk about a $70 a month benefit in rent, which you'll hear talk about, that's a big difference in a family income. So just one other point I wanted to make. In 2007, the Housing Alliance supported an expansion of the tax credit, so it currently has three uses, and you'll hear talk about those today. The housing tax credit was always used for multiple unit rental housing. We expanded it to be eligible for nonprofit and resident co-op purchases of manufactured home parks because we saw the real need to preserve existing affordable housing throughout the state and also the preservation of housing that has existing federal rent subsidy contracts. And so you'll hear talk of that today again. So with that, I think we're going to turn it over. We did decide to kind of start off with a lot of the mechanics and detail. We know that you're the detail-oriented wonk committee, so we would tend to usually be a little bit more emotional and dramatic, but we decided to go with the details today. So
we're also very cool.
Well, of course.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Vliet, and I'm the Executive Director of NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. And we're a nonprofit loan fund that provides a variety of different loan products for affordable housing projects around the state. Our primary program is permanent lending for affordable multifamily rental housing projects. And almost all of the loans that we have in our portfolio, which is over $100 million, use the OAHTC to help lower the interest rate and lower rents to tenants in those projects. Even though the sunset is a few years away, it's important to extend the sunset today. Affordable housing projects typically have a 2 to 4 year development timeline to assemble the really complicated financial packages that go with them. And we need to know early in the process if this resource is going to be available on these projects. The OHTC provides a very efficient way to serve very low-income households through lower rents. And it's also a strong tool to leverage private capital. The program results in sizable increases in the amount of private debt for both the preservation and manufactured home parks that Janet alluded to a moment ago that were added to the program. And this private capital lessens the need for other public resources to fill funding gaps. So we're able to use the private sector capital with this program. The OHTC essentially allows lenders to reduce their interest rates on loans for affordable housing by 4% over 20 years and claim a state income tax credit equal to the lost interest income from the lower rate. In most cases, property owners must agree to pass through 100% of interest savings to low-income tenants in the form of rent reductions. Owners may choose to reduce rents equally to all units, or they may significantly reduce rents on fewer units to provide housing that's affordable to very low-income households. So I'd like to walk you through a couple of examples, and I think you have some tables in your packet that I'll be referring to on this. I want to just explain the mechanics of it, of how the program works, and it also will show, I think, the benefit from the policy perspective.
This is starting with table one.
Yes, we'll be starting with table one. And this shows, in fact, all of these tables, the two tables, one and two, refer to the same project, and it shows it carrying all the way through, and I'm hoping that consistency will help clarify. Table one is for a 37-unit project with a loan amount of $1,175,000. The blue shading in that table represents a market rate loan. The green shading on the table shows the effects of a loan with the OAHTC. With the OHTC, a bank normally would make a permanent loan at 6.75% today, that's as an example, and they would be able to make that same loan for 2.75% and recover the lost revenue as a state income tax credit. The lower interest rate results in lower loan payments to the lender, and then this in turn allows property owners to charge lower rents and still be able to pay back that loan. At a market interest rate, rents will be at the maximum of 60% of the area median income, which is the standard in affordable housing. And that would generate rental income of $275,000 per year.
Madam Chair, could we be referred again to the table? A couple of us are not able to find it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Which packet is it in?
Third to the last page of Senate Bill 900.
In that packet.
Okay. Find Senate Bill 900
in the packet.
Okay. It looks like that.
So it's about the third
to the last page.
The third and fourth pages in. Yeah.
All right. Sorry to interrupt.
That's all right. No,
a couple of us on this end, we're not getting there.
You need to have it.
It took me a while, too.
I'm sorry. I jumped in too fast.
Okay.
It's table one. It looks like this.
Ours is not in color.
I'm sorry. Ours is in color. So
that's all right. We
the blue is on the left, and the green are in the middle. In the blue column now, that's the blue column, which is not blue on yours, the left-hand column are rents without the OHTC, and that's at the 6.75% interest rate. The middle column that says rents with, and that's at a lower rate, which is 2.75%, that has the benefit of the credit.
Oh, I see, down below. Yeah. Got it.
Okay. So at the market interest rate, the rents would be at 60%, which you see the AMI column up above on each of these different examples. And that would raise $275,000 per year in rental income. That's what that would produce.
Tell me again what AMI means.
AMI is the area median income, which is how you determine affordability, really, essentially. And it's the test that is used. And rents to be affordable need to be no more than 30% of tenants' income level. Okay. So you can see that we start at 60% of area median income, and with the OHTC, we're able to serve households that range from 46 to 53% of the area median income, and that's a considerable reduction of affordability when you in income levels. And in this example, the OHTC allows this project to lower its rents by a total of about $45,000 per year to the tenant's benefit. And that averages out to $101 per unit per month in rent savings with the benefit of this tax credit. The effectiveness of the OHTC is also demonstrated in that next column over that shows a loan at a market interest rate but keeping the same rents that would be achieved with the OHTC. So if we wanted to serve the same populations that we're serving with the OHTC, but we had to do it without this credit, we would have to drop our loan amount from $1,175,000 down to $740,000 for this project.
Which would mean additional subsidy.
Right, and that means that $435,000 reduction would have to be made up with other subsidies if we wanted to be able to serve these lower income households that this credit program allows us to do. So on table two is the second half of...
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell us on table one what the amount of the credit would be for this example?
Yes, that next table
You're
on table
getting
two
that.
Is
Sorry.
Going to show you exactly that. It's a great question. So on table two, since you don't have the colors that I do, the left-hand column that says loan with OHTC, the next one over is the loan without the OHTC. The next one over, again, is the loan with the OHTC. And then we get into a tax credit calculation, and you can see how that works, and then how the rent pass-through is calculated off that. So let me just walk you through that real quickly. It's all based on amortization schedules, both with and without the OHTC. The annual credit claim by a lender is calculated in two different ways based off these two amortization schedules. Column A of the tax credit calculation shows the actual foregone interest income during the year, and column B shows the 4% tax credit applied against the average outstanding loan during that year. And lenders claim the lesser of those two calculations each year. So in this case, in the second year, which is highlighted, the tax credit that would be claimed would be $45,410 in that year by the lender. In order for the credit to work, we have to get to a fixed rent pass-through over that 20-year term of the loan. And in this case, what we do is we get the average of the total credit over the year, over the 20-year term of the loan. So the total credits add up to $694,000 over the life of the loan. You take the average of that per unit per month, and you get to an annual rent pass-through for the project that has to be provided from the owner back to the residents. And so the average of the total credits claimed over the 20 years ends up being $34,992 per year. And you can see then that's applied every single year throughout the course of the 20-year period of the program on a loan-by-loan basis.
Bill, what is your baseline for determining the rent reduction? What's the base on that?
So the rent reduction is calculated by taking the amount of the credit claimed, which is the $694,000, and then we convert that into an equivalent rent reduction by averaging it over 20 years.
But reduced from what? The average?
So that's the foregone interest is what drives that. The rent reduction, then, so we calculate the interest expense at a market interest rate, and then we calculate the interest expense at the reduced interest rate, and that savings then gets converted to the rent reductions.
And what rate of return are you assuming?
There's no rate of return. It's simply the difference in the foregone interest.
Right. I'm trying to determine what a market rent, how you determine market rate rent.
The market rate, so the market rate would be a loan, a typical loan without the credit that a bank would make on a similar project.
No, I'm talking about the market rent. How do you determine the market rent?
So the market rent is determined, it's a completely separate calculation, and that's determined by appraisals in what the market rent, if absent any of these restrictions, would be. But we're not calculating the difference in the market rent. It's the market interest rate that drives the amount of the credit reduction.
No, I understand that. Okay. I'm just trying to figure out, you've reduced it $81 a month.
Correct.
But $81 from what?
So the beginning point is the baseline or the other subsidies that are beginning on the project, right? You want to answer?
How do you determine?
Because she actually, as an owner.
This is a simple question. How do you determine what the rent would be if there were none of this?
Cost.
The actual true rent. I mean, you're reducing it by $81. $81 from what? How do you reach that calculation?
So maybe I could step in. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the executive director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit developer. Basically, what we would start with, in terms of the financing that we put together, we are required to have rents that are below market. Our financing partners would start by saying that our rents need to be at least 10% below market. And then we do it kind of backwards. We say, here's all of the different sources that I can bring to this project.
Yeah, and I understand all that. How do you determine market?
It's not off of the market rent. It's off of the rent that I would otherwise have to charge.
Okay.
So if my financing sources all together...
How do you determine... I think this is a simple question. $81 less a month than you would normally charge. How do you determine that figure of what you would normally charge?
It's the amount that I would need to charge if I had a market rate mortgage. If I had that mortgage and I had those mortgage payments, I would need to charge rent that's that much higher.
Correct. And would there be a rate of return factored in there?
No, not particularly. I need to demonstrate to my financing partners that I have meet a debt coverage ratio requirement. So I need to be able to show that I'm going to have a cushion year to year on average over what my pure operating expenses are. But it's not calculated as a rate of return in a classic market sense.
Okay. I think you have somebody behind you who... Are you coming up later?
I am coming up later. So
okay, we'll store your answer for later. Let's move on. Thank you.
I catch up, figure out where in my notes we were.
Sorry for that diversion.
No, that's all right.
Committee.
There's a lot of different computations that then all get layered on top of each other.
Madam
so
Chair, you know
understand.
Representative Bennett.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe we could get to the answer by going back to Table 1 just for a moment. And if you could go to the column that says rents without OAHTC, just tell us where those rents came from. It says rents / unit month. Where do those numbers come from?
Okay, so those are derived. Those are the maximum rents that are deemed affordable for households at 60% of the area median income. So that becomes the beginning point.
Okay. And follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
And so tell us where you got the number.
Okay, so that number, 60%, is that most every one of these projects also has low-income housing tax credit allocation, which is a separate program that's a federal program. And the most you can ever charge under that program is 60% of the median income.
And median income is determined
determined by HUD.
And median income is established by HUD.
And the follow-up. And to get us all to the same page, why don't you just take us through that calculation? Just tell us exactly each number and show us how you got to the numbers in that column, because I think that's your starting point. I think that answers the senator's question, I'm hoping.
Yes. And so HUD calculates area median income for different counties all over the state. And so the median incomes actually change depending on where a project is located. And it's all based on, I believe it starts with census data and then is updated regularly for that. So they establish for different household sizes what the area median income is based on household size. And that number becomes then median income. Then we reduce that to meet the compliance with other programs down to what the 60% of that median income is. Then to get to the rent, the HUD standard for affordable rent is 30%. A household should not pay more than 30% of their income for rent. So then that goes through the math, and you take 30% of the monthly income of a household at 60% of the median income. So that sets the maximum limit under the federal rules.
And a follow-up. And is that the number then that we're looking at in that column that says rents without OAHTC? Rent/unit/month, is that the number that
Correct.
Reached?
Okay. And that becomes the baseline then.
And then one follow-up. So does, I don't want to say real rent, ever come into play here? If we go out into the market and find out what the rent is in a certain county, does that ever come into play, or is it merely factored through the median, the area median income test to get us where we want to go? Is that the closest we're ever going to come to, quote, local real?
So local real factors in during the project development process and during the underwriting and financing process, where all of us involved on the financing side care very much about what the market rents are, because we want to make sure that these projects are priced well below the market rent so they're competitive against just standard market projects.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, Representative Vance. Okay. Go ahead.
So on Table 2, it just walks through the process really of laying out how that tax credit then is computed and what the pass-through needs to be on a monthly basis. So if you go back then to Table 1, you'll see two things. One is that the actual pass-through for the demonstration project here, shown over on the far right-hand side where it says OHTC test, that bottom number, the actual pass-through for this project is about $45,000 per year. And you note that the tax credit calculations, the minimum pass-through requirement to comply is about $35,000 a year. So this project actually is exceeding the minimum requirements of the program by about $10,000 per unit. $10,000 per year. So in this way, and this happens for a couple of reasons. One is that because there is a compliance component to this, and project owners want to make sure they're clearly in compliance with Oregon Housing and Community Services annual reviews, they like to go beyond the minimum requirements, so there's a cushion. And the other component of that is that projects get awarded based on a competitive process, and the more affordability you can provide, the more likely it is you'll get funded through the state's allocation process. So those two factors really come into driving the fact that a lot of these projects, almost all of them, well over-deliver on the rent reductions compared to what the minimum requirements would be under the tax credit. So in this way, it's more than 100% efficient. And I think it's important to note, this credit is not discounted and sold like a lot of other tax credits are to an investor. And over the life of the credit, the owners are delivering rent discounts well beyond the amount of the foregone tax credits claimed by the lenders. And as a result, then, more than 100% of the credit delivers a direct public policy benefit. So it's a very efficient program as far as delivering that policy objective compared to the cost back to the public. So real quickly to finish up, because I know we're in a hurry here, there are the two exceptions that Janet talked about early on for the preservation properties and for the manufactured housing parks. Because of preservation properties, the way those projects operate, they were exempted from the pass-through requirement. The preservation projects, the rent is mostly paid by HUD, so it wouldn't make sense. There's really not a mechanism for reducing that rent. So what we're able to do then is keep the rents up and use the lower interest rate to generate more leverage from the private sector. And so we're able to essentially use the credit to get more private capital into these deals than we otherwise would be able to. And tables 3 and 4 gives you a really quick, simple computation of what that would be. Table 3 is a preservation project. Table 4 is a manufactured home example, both live projects that NOAA's been involved with. And you can see that if we did not have the tax credit, there would have to be additional public subsidy of a pretty sizable amount to make these projects feasible.
And again, the preservation is important because if they go out of affordable housing, then the Section 8 vouchers are lost.
Right. The contracts disappear. Okay. Absolutely.
All right.
So the residents are the primary beneficiaries of the program, regardless, across the board. The developers benefit from having projects that serve lower-income households, that fulfills their mission. And banks benefit from having an ability to finance projects that reach very low-income households, and they receive favorable treatment under the Community Reinvestment Act for that. This program leverages significant private capital. So for every $1 million of state credit, that leverages $25 million of private debt that goes into these projects. And in NOAA's portfolio, we're only financing about 25% of total project costs with that debt. So that really leverages up to total development investments in the state between $75 and $100 million based on a $1 million state tax credit. So there's great leveraging going on with this credit program that is pretty remarkable. And the investments create jobs as well as affordable housing. A recent Center for Housing Policy report that studied the role of affordable housing, creating jobs and stimulating local economic development, cited a National Association of Home Builders recent study that said that for every 100 units of affordable housing that are created, more than 120 construction jobs are generated, and then approximately 30 ongoing jobs, permanent jobs, to operate the project are created. So this is a good program. It's had strong results on multiple levels, and we request that you please support the extension of the sunset now to get projects into the queue so we can continue to develop more affordable housing.
Thank you. Did you have anything to add?
Sure. My name, again, is Martha McLennan. I'm Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit affordable housing developer and owner located in Milwaukee. Our mission is to create opportunity through housing, and that's the opportunity for security, for stability, and for dignity. And we believe that housing really provides people the foundation that they need to succeed in life. I wanted to provide two concrete examples of how this program is used. I think the clerk has handout for you. So one is the Charleston Apartments. This is a 52-unit building that we've recently completed in the Wilsonville community. 37 of the units in that property provide entry-level workforce housing or housing opportunities for retired seniors. The remaining 15 units in the property are targeted for folks in recovery from mental illness. In this particular property, the average income of the households per month is $1,340. The OHTC in this particular case provided a rent savings of $47 per month per household. Again, what this is the difference between the rent we would have had to charge if we had had to have a first mortgage at market rate. The other property that I wanted to highlight is the Quimby Apartments. This is a property in Bend. This is a preservation project. We acquired it and rehabilitated it in 2010. It is also 52 units. And we have now renewed the HUD contract for rental assistance for 20 years so that we know that that rental assistance will be available. At this property, the average household income is $984 a month. And because it's a preservation project and has the rent assistance for the residents, this used the OHTC in that slightly different model where what it did is maximize the amount of private debt that we could bring into the deal, meaning that we didn't have to bring in other subsidy sources. So in this particular case, we were able to leverage an additional $550,000 of private market debt that would have required gap subsidy sources from the state, federal, or local government if we hadn't had the OHTC. In both these properties, you know, we're serving extremely low-income households. While the examples that Mr. Van Vliet gave you are at the 60th percentile, these folks have incomes that are closer to the 30th percentile. So there are folks who really would not be able to afford market rate rents. Back on the Charleston, just one thing I would say, those one-bedroom apartments right now rent for $525 a month. The average market rents in Wilsonville are probably over $700 a month. So we start by bringing the rents way below market. That's part of our mission, part of the requirement of the funding sources, both from their interest in making sure that the projects succeed, that we have that margin from the market, and in terms of meeting the mission of both the funding sources and our agency. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We've already asked quite a few, but are there more questions for this panel? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get back to the market basis for the discussion. We've had several different bases for the discussion. I think most of the basis for the conversation that we've been having is based on the cost of the unit and what it costs to take to amortize.
Barnhart, we had somebody come up who said he thought he could address that.
Well, I want to talk about it. I'm going to ask the question, and then if they want to answer it, fine. If they don't, then we'll get to the next, if I may.
Okay.
Question is this. Can you give us an idea of the percentage of the total population in the qualifying AMI? What you've told us is the percent of a standard. But I don't know how that translates to people.
So the median income is the middle. Half the people in the state have incomes less than the median. Half have incomes more than.
Right.
So if you go to the 60th percentile of that, so that's...
We're talking about 30% of the population.
Yes.
Thank you. That really helps me understand the rest of the numbers. If I have one more that I think fits with this. And then the percentage of the housing in the area that qualifies for the rents that those people can pay. I mean, I'm assuming, and I may be wrong, but I'm assuming that one of the things you think about when you're thinking about where you site low-income housing is the location as it relates to available rents in other housing. And
so
that hence the question.
Mm-hmm. In Clackamas County, there are 30,000 households who are in this income, who are below 50% of the area median income, who have a high rent burden. That means they're either paying more than 30% of their income to rent or more than 50% of their income to rent. So that's just in Clackamas County.
So, and I think the department wants to add to this, but all from an underwriter standpoint, I can tell you what we look at with that, which I think gets to it.
Thank you.
And that is that we care deeply that there is going to be a strong demand for this product and that it is reaching a population that's not currently being served, because we want our projects full. So we're looking, there's market studies for every project that we receive in the appraisal that lay out the universe, the population of universe of potential households within a certain demographic that would fit with this. They talk about the number of those that are unhoused or underhoused or extremely rent burdened. And we make sure there is a large compelling demand for that in order for us to move forward. And then the other piece that we do is we look at, regardless of the 60% or anything else, we look at what the concluded market rents are from that appraisal and we look to make sure that our rents are significantly, with this program, below that. But we don't want people making housing choices away from this project if they're qualified to live here. We want them to live here. We want them to get the benefit. So we always build that buffer in, and it's pretty rigid. And if this project doesn't meet a significant reduction off of whatever else is available in the market, we won't do the deal.
One more question, if I may. Do these projects reduce the number of, I'll use your word, unhoused in the area?
I think clearly they do, both directly and indirectly. We're serving a lot of very, very low-income households out there that without, but for this housing, would be at a high risk of homelessness.
And that turns out I have one more question.
One more.
Tell us your experience of people who qualify for this housing, and then because they're in housing, they're able to get their lives together and increase their income and move to something that's closer to the market.
So let me tell you a story about one of the residents at the Charleston apartment.
I'm sorry, if I may. Madam Chair, I'm not interested in an anecdote, although it's perfectly okay to say one. I'm really interested in percentages.
In the statistics.
The statistics. Anecdotes are not data.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think there's not cold, hard data that would give you that. There are a couple things that I can tell you that are relevant. If we look at Section 8 subsidies and how long people end up holding a Section 8 subsidy in the Portland metro area, that's about 5 years. And so those are going to be extremely low-income people. And we know that they are moving off of housing subsidy. One of the reasons it's difficult to give you a really precise answer is that there's a wide range of people that need affordable housing. So Martha referenced in the Charleston, a percentage of those units are reserved for people with chronic mental illness. We know that some people always are going to need permanent housing with some support, some case management, some sort of extra help. And so we don't expect those people to move to self-sufficiency. What we try to do, and I know that that Mr. Gillespie's testimony talks about this, you know, we try to look at what that range of community needs is and then how we can, as a system, address those needs. Martha's projects, other projects, and I think Mr. Moorfield, who's going to talk next about his projects in Corvallis, provide a lot of resident services, provide home ownership training opportunities. We have different asset building opportunities that folks try to make available to residents. So that's all part of a system. But you know, some people are never going to reach self-sufficiency. Some people do use this clearly as a stepping stone to stability.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's very helpful. I appreciate the
thank you for
indulgence.
Your questions.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one question from the lender's perspective. I know at the federal level, the low-income housing tax credit program has recapture provisions should the project ever fall out of compliance. Because this is a third party not having ownership in the property and the credit extends to you as the lender, should the project fall out of compliance, what happens to the credit to the lender? Is there a recapture? Does it just go away on a forward basis? What happens in that particular case?
Well, the department can clarify this as the enforcer of that, but our understanding and belief is that the credit goes away if they're out of compliance and don't correct it, and then we would end up having to raise the interest rate back up, which would then have an effect on the project and the rents within that. There's not a recapture that I'm aware of, but there may be.
Just prospectively,
they would lose it, and it would be very disruptive, which is why we check this very carefully, both during underwriting. We're watching pass-through amounts, and then whenever there's rent increases, we're comparing those to make sure that they're still complying with the pass-through amounts over time of the projects. We don't want a non-compliance event that puts a project at risk.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been very helpful. Next, we'll have Bob Gillespie and Jim Moorfield.
Good Welcome.
Hello, my name is Jim Warfield. I'm executive director with Willamette Neighborhood Housing Services in Corvallis, and we serve Lynn and Benton counties. I want to give you an example of how this works in the life of a real family at a real place in Corvallis, a property that we developed in 2002, Camas Commons. In Corvallis, a big issue is that a lot of people who work in Corvallis can't afford to live there. And so we've focused as a nonprofit developer on developing workforce housing in Corvallis. We serve other populations as well. But a lot of the people that we serve and a lot of the properties that we've developed really focus on low-income working people who need a good place, an affordable place to live. So in 2002, we built Camas Commons, 56 units. And because we're serving workforce housing for low-income families, the gap in Corvallis is larger units, three-bedroom apartments. So 30 of the 56 units at Camas Commons are three-bedroom apartments. And in a market rent, a fair market rent in Corvallis for a three-bedroom unit, this year is approaching $1,200 a month. And so using an example of a nursing aide in Corvallis, someone who works at Good Samaritan Hospital or works at one of the retirement communities, a median hourly wage for a nursing aide in Corvallis is $11.51 an hour. There's some that make less, there's some that make more. The median wage is $11.51 an hour. But for someone to afford a rental in Corvallis that costs almost $1,200 a month, that person would have to make about over $47,000 in income. If we use the standard, you're not paying any more than 30% of your income on rent and utilities. A nursing aide making $11.51 an hour isn't anywhere close to that. A nursing aide at $11.51 an hour can afford, using the standard, about $600 a month in rent and utilities. So at Camas Commons, we structured the financing to make the rent somewhere in the vicinity of what she can afford for her and her children for a three-bedroom unit. An example is more charts and graphs for you are being handed out right now, but I want to zero in on, and I gave an example in the handout of a number of different professions, but zeroing in on the nursing aide, with other forms of subsidy that we use at Camas Commons, we can get the rent from, in the area of a market rent of $1,200 a month down to about $935 is a maximum rent that's allowable under other programs that we use to finance the project. But then we add the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit to the mix, and we can get that rent down to about $649 a month. Now, that's still slightly above what she can afford for her and her family, but it's a whole lot closer than $1,200 a month that she might have to face in a if she were in the competing in the market for a three-bedroom unit. So what we're left with is a family that is living in a place that's a lot more affordable, and we have a family that is a lot less likely having to choose between paying the rent every month and putting food on the table. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Just a brief question. My colleague and I were here conferring about another interesting piece of information here. You list the median hourly wage of house cleaners and maids at $9.32 and janitors and cleaners at $11.01. Is there a difference between those positions besides the gender of those performing them?
That's not funny.
It's not funny. $2 an hour.
I got this data off the Oregon Employment Division for Region 4, Lynn Benton and Lincoln Counties.
Thank you.
Good point. Representative Gibson. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Bob Gillespie. I'm the administrator of the Housing Division for Oregon Housing and Community Services. And first, to go back to the question about how we establish the base rents, and I actually think that Representative Bence's line of questioning got to what I wanted to say. But I think it's important to understand that the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is very, very rarely ever used alone. Usually there's other affordable housing programs that go along with it. And with that, they have maximum rents that you can go to. And we won't accept an application for OHDC if they're not already meeting the program rents of one of those other programs. So that's the baseline where we start. So if, for instance, if the federal low-income housing tax credits say you can't go over 60% of median income, if they're applying for OHDC, they have to show us the rents at 60 and then what the rent reduction is passed on from below 60% of median income. So we always start with the baseline of whatever the other program is that they're applying for. And then we do, particularly with low-income housing tax credits, order appraisals. So the issue of what market rents are, we have that in the analysis, and we want to make sure, as Bill was saying, that these projects are 10 to 20% below market as well. So as a department, we try to take care of that. As a committee, you have a series of questions about all the credit programs. I've, in the handout that has been given to you, which I believe was passed out by the clerk, we've answered those questions. I don't think in the respective time I'll go through all the answers to those questions. Instead, I'll let you review those at your leisure. Instead, I'll jump to page 9, and it's the question, is the credit effective and efficient? A way to achieve the affordable housing policies. First, I'd say that the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is extremely efficient to administer for the department. It takes a fraction of an FTE to administer this program. So certainly it's very efficient for the department to administer. As far as the effectiveness of it, as folks were saying, these credits are awarded on a competitive basis, and we do get 2 to 2.5 times the applications that that we can fund in any given funding round, and enables us to choose amongst the best of the applications that meet the community affordable housing need. And in our applications as well, we have an analysis of need, both for special needs populations and for workforce housing that's for every county of the state. And we assign points as to whether it's a 1, 2, or 3. And you really, if you're not addressing one of the highest needs in one of those counties, the likelihood of getting funded is low because you lose points in the application process. So that makes it a very effective way of meeting the needs for affordable housing around the state of Oregon. And then as far as accountability, I think it was mentioned, we do write the OHTC rents into all the documents. Whatever they say they're going to provide as rents, it goes into the tax credit, the federal tax credit documents, the HUD-funded documents, anything we have. If they have OHTC, those rents get put into the documents. The Asset and Property Management Division monitors to make sure that they're meeting those rent requirements, and we also have our partners submit a certificate of compliance with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit on an annual basis. So we do hold people accountable to what they said they're going to do. I would jump to page 14 in the packet, and there's a chart there, and this talks about the benefits of the tax credit and affordable housing. I think some of this has been covered, but this is a little bit different way of looking at it, and it looks like this, if you see it. So as we look at the benefits of it, and this is since 2009, of what we've done with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, we've issued $1.9 million in credits, and as Bill was saying, that leverages the private financing. For every dollar of credit you put out, you get $25 in affordable loans. So the $1.9 million in credits equals the $47.2 million in loans. And that's capital that we wouldn't have had that would have reduced our ability to produce the number of affordable housing units that we have. We talked about preservation a little bit. And if the units that we have preserved that have the federal rent assistance, you know, is important to us as a department. That's one of our priorities. If we had to replace that housing, if it had been lost, that would have been at a cost of $144 million. That same, in the same time period, we preserved the rent subsidies, which over a 20-year period would have brought will bring $70.2 million in federal subsidies to the state that house some of the neediest populations in the state. Most are below 30% of median income, and many of them are elderly. And then finally, we calculate the economic stimulus, and a little bit about that. The economic stimulus is calculated using something called the IM plan that was developed by the University of Minnesota. It's a rather well-respected input-output analysis, and it basically takes all the costs that go into a development and calculates what the multiplier will be and then also the leverage of funds. So for every dollar that we put into affordable housing of state dollars, it has an economic stimulus of $11, which is a factor of the multiplier and the leverage of other resources. So as we look at the total benefits are $383.3 million. The cost of the state of that $1.9 million in OHTC, since it's taken over 20 years, would be $28.5 million. The gap financing we put in was $15.3 million for a total cost of $43.8 million. And then the net benefit is $339.5 million in economic or in benefit to the state of Oregon. So it's And then quickly the summary of it, I think you've heard that this does leverage bank and private financing, that 100% of the credits go to the tenants. It's not discounted like other tax credit programs. I believe it's extremely efficient for us to operate that. And again, the credits aren't discounted. It does deliver an economic stimulus both during construction and for the ongoing operation of the properties. And it does free the tenants to have more disposable income for other necessities such as food, clothing, and medical expenses. And then finally, on the very last page, we've done 363 developments with OHTC over the years, and it shows the different counties in which we've put the different developments in. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for directly addressing the questions that we asked that you did. We appreciate that you took the time to look at those. Some have not. Page 4 of your handout has affordable rental housing needs. Would you explain the source of that data?
Sure. So there's three columns of numbers there. And the populations, in large part, we got those population numbers with the assistance of Department of Human Services.
Is this, I guess my question is this data that you keep at all times, or is this something you gleaned for this presentation? Is this
No. Representative Berger, when I was talking about how we do the needs analysis, this is something that we always update.
So you keep track of this data and these numbers at the agency?
Right.
So in a way, the source of this data is you?
That is, the source of the data of us with the assistance of a lot of other folks.
Yes. Okay, that's what I'm asking.
That's correct.
This is data that you keep and monitor. And I'm getting these head nods behind me.
Yeah.
that's the answer to my question. Okay.
Other questions of this panel? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, that completes our witness list. Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on this? Yeah, we'll close the public hearings on Senate Bill 900, Senate Bill 823, and House Bill 2527, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 817. Chris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 817. Creates the Oregon Low-Income Community Jobs Initiative, creates an income and corporate excise tax credit equal to 39% of the cost of qualified equity investments. And the credit is taken over 7 years. There's no credit for the first 2 years, and then in the subsequent years, it goes 7% in year three, and then 8% in the last 4 years. The credit is non-refundable and can be carried forward to any tax year, and limits the total amount of credits that can be claimed to $16 million. For any 1 year, and would apply to qualified investments made between July 1, 2012 and June 30th, 2016.
Okay, we'll start out with Kevin Campbell and Ryan Brennan.
Well, good morning, Chair Burdick, Chair Berger, Chair Bailey, and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of my brother and I, and I know our sanity has been questioned in this busy session why we are bringing a bill that we have no client for. And I will tell you this much. If we were not fully convinced this was an idea worth pursuing, I wouldn't spend a moment on it. I have far too many things to do. But that being said, Craig and I have tried to work on this in the last couple of years, and we have become convinced this is a very valuable project for the state, especially at a time when budget crisis continues to put valuable programs at risk, and yet there seems like there's a limited number of tools for how do you answer the question, how do you bring jobs and the right kind of jobs into Oregon. So we're glad to be a part of this today. I'm thankful to have some experts with me that have come along to help explain how this project works in detail. I don't claim to be an expert, but I've done enough investigation to feel very comfortable myself in this particular program. I want to thank the committee. A number of you are sponsors of this bill today, but all of you have been gracious with your time to sit down and go through the provisions of this measure. And so for that, I'm very thankful. Okay. What I'm going to do today is briefly go through this, talk about the basics, and then I'm going to turn it over to Ryan Brennan. You're receiving two documents. One is kind of the 20,000-foot level overview of the project. The other addresses your committee questions specifically. You outlined a number of questions that you felt like were interested the committee that would help you vet these credits and determine what the committee might do in terms of value. And so we've attempted to answer each of those questions in the document. Ryan will be going over some of that in a minute. I wanted to begin just by saying that at the federal level, the new market tax credit program is a 39% seven-year tax credit. It's popular. Started with the Clinton administration. It was bipartisan from the start and has continued to be advanced in each of the three succeeding presidencies after that, and is a very popular federal program. What states began to do is they began to say, because the federal new markets tax credits can go anywhere, they can go to any state, how is it that we draw them into our own state? And so states like Missouri, Louisiana, and others have created a program similar to the one you're seeing here today. Basically, the 39% tax credit is available for investment in what's called a low-income community based on the census, and that's based on census tracts, which are about a five-block area, in areas where the income is 20% below the state average. Actually, Oregon has a very attractive map, which is probably not a good thing for the state of Oregon, and we expect that when the new census data is released, it will become even more attractive in terms of low-income areas, which means we're probably not going in the right direction. As we looked at the previous map and what we expect in the future, we think that statewide there's going to be opportunity here. Regardless of what district you represent, there are areas of your district where these jobs could be drawn and investment could be drawn. At the federal level, what they call allocatees, entities that actually go and apply to be given credits for investment, go through a rigorous process. At the federal level, it's probably one of the most rigorous processes these groups have to go through in order to gain access to the credits for investment. That's an advantage for us here in the state because the federal government does a tremendous amount of work to ensure that the investor is well vetted. That's important for us because some of the tax credits the state of Oregon are involved in, all the pressure is on the state to vet the companies that are investing, to vet individual projects. At the federal level, the vetting is done there, which is very nice. I want to talk just briefly about the advantages of this credit and why we've designed it the way we have. The nice thing, as I said, is there are several states that have a little bit of a track record with this already. Very good results, and we've been able to take their experience and adapt it so it works even better here in Oregon. So let me just go through these briefly. We have the track record in other states, and I mentioned we have a very low administrative cost. There's a $3 million investment cap in this bill, and the reason we've done that is you could increase this investment, any one investment cap, up as high as $20 million and above, and if you do that, you get a different kind of result. What we wanted to do was lower the investment cap in order to ensure that the kind of investments we're receiving deal with small business. That's the jobs you really want. You want good-paying, family-wage jobs in these low-income census tracts with benefits. And in other states, that's been the result. But we had to make sure that the investment cap was low enough that that's the kind of result you're getting. It's targeted to small business. In this bill, there is no stacking of the credits. It's not allowed. There's no sale of the credits outside of the deal. They have to remain within the deal. If two things happen within these investments. If the business that's invested in either repays any or all of the investment prematurely within the 7-year period, the state has the ability to recover that, or the investor must reinvest in that low-income census tract. Or if that business leaves that low-income area within the 7 years, the state also has that clawback provision, which is important. Now, there's no need for a sunset provision in this bill. It sets an investment cap for the total program. Once that investment is exhausted, the program goes away, unless the legislature deems this a valuable enough project to go another round. In Louisiana, for instance, they just approved their fourth round with this new markets tax credit match. It's been successful in other states, and we really believe here it will be successful as well. Obviously, I'm going to turn it over to Ryan, but obviously I'm very high on this. I believe that there are a number of good examples of how this has worked in any number of businesses. And for all of your districts that you represent, it gives an opportunity to direct capital that's very hard to come by right now into some very worthy projects, and to sustain, to create a stickiness that ensures that these projects continue to be valuable, not in the first year, the second year, but 7 years, 10 years, and beyond. Long-term investment in small business, very important. And with that, chairs and members of the committee, I'd like to turn it over to Ryan Brennan with Advantage Capital Partners, and he can introduce himself and put him on the record and take you through additional detail. Thank you.
You're welcome, Ryan.
Chair Burdick, chairs, thank you. Ryan Brennan with Advantage Capital Partners from California, and thank you for your time today. Advantage Capital, I've had the pleasure with of either testifying in front of or visiting personally with many of you, so it's good to have this conversation again. Advantage Capital is one of the 300 firms or so nationally that Kevin talked about. The 2000 legislation that created the Federal New Markets Tax Credit Program very quickly became very competitive, where firms like ours would go to the Department of Treasury, fill out an 80-page form of our track record, our ability to bring in private investment, our ability to produce results, jobs, and economic benefit. That 80-page application, there were about 250 of us that applied that first year, go in front of four blind scorers to take the name and the location off. They go through and say, what is this firm's ability to produce not only the track record that they've had in the past, but future economic development results. Score us all and decide which of the 50 or so of those 250 are allowed to participate in that year. After we have invested whatever money we received, and it's really investment authority, it's not direct cash from the government, but after we've invested that money, on an annual basis, we have to go back to them with specific economic output numbers to show a few things. What jobs, where did we put the money? Is it consistent with our business plan? Did we invest in small business? What did they do with the money? How did we help that low-income business? Not just did we invest, but what portion of the credit benefit did we flow through to them? Did they get a lower interest rate? Did we use part of that money as their down payment? And we have to give, grant, push down as much of that benefit as possible, because that then becomes how we are judged in the next round of application. We're now in the 11th year of those applications. Some years Advantage is successful, some years we are not. There are usually 250 or 300 cities, counties, private firms, large banks that all go in and apply for this money on an annual basis, and it is getting tougher. Every year we, and this is the portion of the program, we push more of that benefit to the company and have to show the results of that in order to, we think, be successful and eligible for the next rounds. I say all that in that these mechanics, the pages that we have written out in the legislation, represent the last 6 years of state experience, the seven other states that have done this. This represents best practices. This represents the state's interest. The credit is as low as possible. The recapture is as tough as possible. The targeting is tight. $3 million per investment is low. I think that's good. We've learned that in other states, so you can go low and force that money into small business. But I bring up that federal picture so you understand anybody who participates in the Oregon program not only needs to be responsible to you and to the citizens, they also have to be responsible to the Department of Treasury. So every time you do a deal through the state program, That you also have to answer for that deal, and how have you pushed the benefit through to the company when you go back to the Department of Treasury? And I think when we strip away all of these mechanics, and I'm happy to walk through any of them in absolute detail, but when you strip those away, this really is a job creation program. The federal program just turned about 10 years old. Passed in 2000, implemented in 2001. Federal program just turned about 10 years old. Article written 2 days ago reports that they estimate direct jobs, not indirect, direct jobs of 500,000 jobs created. Compare that with the current cost of the federal government. That comes out to about $12,000 per job. The federal standard, as you know, is about $45,000 per job. And then you have to ask yourself, well, why is this efficient? Why is this moving the needle so quickly or in such a dramatic way? And what we're finding, what I expect other participants are finding, is that there is tremendous pent-up demand for capital at the small business level. And that those capital uses are very real. It's not a new water cooler in the corner. It is employees to go out and sell a product. It is machines to make something that can be sold. You know, sometimes it is about a facility and a building that they need to be in. It's often not. It's often about operating capital. We have clients, we have companies come to us for investments through the New Markets Program that will tell us we've had a banking relationship for a decade. We got a call to say we're just out. That bank wants to, our loan has termed, and they're not going to renew, even though our business is as strong as it's been. Banks are acting in a very peculiar way, as I know you hear from your constituents. We tried to go through, again, in some detail and answer the questions about the efficiency and the efficacy of the New Markets Tax Credit Program. We have states' experience from which to draw. Kevin mentioned the state of Missouri. We picked that because they're probably the longest participant at a program similar to what Oregon is considering, started in 2007. And frankly, the results have been dramatic. And these investments have gone in all the way from a life science company in downtown St. Louis to a brick manufacturing plant in Mexico, Missouri. So it's across the board. It's urban, it's rural, it's high tech, it's service, it's manufacturing. That flexibility, we think, is a real benefit from this program. And I'll go through the results very quickly and then close my testimony. In those first about 4 years, the state has counted 1,900 direct jobs created or retained. I know retained is a fuzzy number. Each of those CEOs has submitted to the state via affidavit the jobs that they believe were retained because of that investment, and then additionally the jobs that were created. The $125 million that's been invested is leveraged an additional $760 million with no tax credit associated from private sources. Average salary of these jobs is about $50,000. $26 million in the first 12 months has been collected back by the state and local governments, and they estimate it's $14.4 million annually that state and local receives back. And the credits in Missouri never go over $12 million a year. So we think there it's showing that it's paying for itself. I will end with, I think that the very specific goal of this legislation, that's to change investor behavior. Oregon did well in the New Markets Program federally early on. Frankly, though, that was a couple of large real estate redevelopment projects. We've not seen the small business impact in Oregon that this bill is designed to solve. The money, as Kevin mentioned, has to stay in the company for 7 years. If they repay the money to us, we have to make a replacement investment, no new credits, in order to keep that 7-year clock going. We are finding that's happening more and more. In Missouri, our average dollar will be invested 3 times because these companies will use it for a few years, and then they'll want to go back to their bank, and they'll want to get rid of us, which is okay. We put the money back out again at no new cost. So the state is actually seeing a lot of activity for that first round of tax credits. And lastly, I will say what we've seen in other states, too, is somebody used the term earlier, sticky. And I think this is one of those credits because it's changing investor behavior to pay attention to Oregon. Once Bank of America does their first small business investment in Oregon, aided by these credits, when these credits are gone, they'll still have those local relationships. They'll still have a pipeline to get deals and companies from Oregon long beyond this original set of tax credits. That's what Missouri, that's what Ohio, that's what Mississippi, that's what Louisiana is finding, is that once these credits become trained on local opportunities, that they're sticking around. gone beyond my time, so sure, but thank you for your interest, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the panel. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. One of the things that struck me in your testimony is this discussion about access to capital for low businesses, for small businesses, and that certainly that's something I hear a lot about, mm-hmm. is the inability to go out and find capital for operating expenses for these businesses. I think many of us on this committee are familiar with new markets tax credits when they relate to sort of some of these large projects like the Catholic Charities building in my district or the Hooper Detox Center or some of those investments, which are good investments. Can you focus a little bit more on this, how this relates to small businesses, and maybe if you could give an example of how a small business might use this and what they might use it for?
Certainly. Thank you. And I'll use the brick manufacturing plant with your permission. Small businesses are certainly a different animal than a building in a downtown area. You know that building's not going to move. Largely how some of these state credits have been used is this extra incentive goes to offset some of that additional risk of small businesses potentially failing. The brick manufacturing plant was shuttered. It was around for 60 years, closed in the early 2000s. As the market started to come back and the employee base was there, there was a desire to restart it. But there's a startup cost for a project like that. It was a $22 million startup cost to get that plant back up and running. They didn't necessarily need the ongoing incentives in order to fund a working line. But of that 22, they could raise about 10. So that 10 became the very senior piece of the loan transaction. Advantage came in with about $3.5 million of new markets investment. And what does that look like? That means that the 39%, or in this case it was about 60% when you layered on the state credit, was worth about 40 cents in, you know, discounted back, use it today capital. That 40 cents became the down payment. That became $3.5 million. In this larger bucket of 22. So we still had the 10. The new markets investment was monetized and used as equity that that company would own at the end of the life of the fund that they otherwise did not have any capacity to use. What do we get out of it? About $750,000 is a fee or so. That's what gets rolled into the loan. And then at the end of it, if there's interest earned that $750,000, Advantage Capital can keep that. This $750,000 goes to the small business. And then we took on the task of going to find the other investors. So we brought in a firm from Maryland and another from Florida to put in more senior safe pieces. But that company then could put together the total 22. We know that doesn't happen but for that $3.5 million in the middle. And most of that ends up back with the company at the end, our abilities to earn interest on the piece that we contribute.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair. And on a slightly different line question, Mr. Campbell, this may be for you or Mr. Brennan. We've seen, I think, at the packet here an indication of a potential fiscal because of the relationship between application fees and potential FTEs. Can you discuss a little bit about the application fees and flexibility perhaps there?
Yeah, Chair Bailey. In answer to your question, we did look at the fiscal, and we're concerned about it. We understand it. I think that Mr. Brennan can speak more specifically to the fiscal, and based on experience in other states, we understand this is a new program. So the departments that are responding to this, obviously it's a new animal in terms of their treatment of this. I will say that our goal would be to match the revenue from the fees with the cost ultimately. If that means a significant increase in the upfront fee, I think that's worthwhile in order to eliminate the concern that this may cost money in this next biennium. I didn't mention, but I should, or maybe I did, I'm not sure, but you know, the matching tax credit the state puts in does not come into play until the third year of the investment. So the business is in the ground for 2 years paying income tax through those new jobs. For 2 years before the state matching tax credit comes into play. And so that's why there's no fiscal on the tax credit side well into the future, but there is a fiscal in terms of the review of these certified companies coming in to make the investments. Mr. Brennan.
And Chair, I would add that the range of application fees varies amongst all seven states. And then the fees, there are sometimes annual audit fees that can go to offset costs by the department to oversee the program. I'd say the program should be flexible with those things. I think if the committee, the legislature, the department feels like there are more dollars necessary to oversee the program, that can be flexible. One benefit I know states have enjoyed is they don't have to create this from whole cloth. They've got a template at Treasury. Our firms are vetted. The other hundreds are vetted. We know that we have to have qualifying investments as determined by Treasury. So the state doesn't have to go through and make sure each of those is qualified. If they're disqualified any time in the 7 years, all credits are recaptured. So everybody makes very sure that that the deals qualify.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for your testimony and for coming. I'm curious if you could, you touched on this to a certain extent, some of the things that are different in this proposal from other states and other experiences, and particularly on the notion of specifically targeting small businesses. But I wonder if there are other lessons that we can learn from other states, other things that if this went forward, we would be doing better, or areas that are worthy of continued experimentation. Mm-hmm. If you could comment on that, please.
And I'll add two that I think are most...
I would ask you to be brief.
Too, yes, ma'am.
Because we're running
yes,
into
thank
time
you.
Problems.
One is the delay of the credits. The early program started in year one, just like the federal program did. People realized you could delay the fiscal impact and still get the money to come in up front, 2 years of economic benefit before there's any credit cost. That's one. Two is the reducing of the per investment size. So for this total program, you know you're going to get 35 plus companies receive investment. We found comfort at that lower level and others have, and I think that's an innovation in the Oregon bill.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions? Representative Brewer.
Just really, really briefly, because this has a 2-year delay for the credits going out, but we have a relatively small current biennium expenditure. Do you have any data that would say, based on 5 applications coming through, how many jobs would be created in this current biennium, the 11-13 biennium, as a result of these 5 applications? Any range of jobs created?
Co-chairs and Representative Brewer, I'll begin the answer just by saying that the 5 applications are actually the companies that would be coming to use their federally allocated, so it may represent a number of investments per application. So the application isn't a per-project application, it's actually an application by the allocated company that brings their tax credits to Oregon. That would be the one clarification. Then, Mr. Brennan, do you
have I'll be very brief. We find it's quick. I would expect Missouri had 1,900 jobs over 4 years. So I would expect you could, and that's for a smaller program. So I would expect you could see 1,000-ish jobs. That would be reasonable. And we think that's true because these companies have projects, customers, products they want to pursue today without the capital to do so. So generally they already have their plans. They're shovel ready, if you want to use that term. It's the capital that unlocks that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Before I call the next panel, I want to just let the audience know that we are going to roll over Senate Bill 317 to our next meeting next Tuesday, right? And everyone signed up is from the building, so I hope that doesn't cause inconvenience. We always have such interesting discussions in this committee. Okay, at this time I will call our next panel on Senate Bill 817, Don Mazziotti and Stephen Brooks. And I would ask you to be very brief, and if you have written testimony, that will go in the record.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I will be extremely brief. I think the two prior testimonians did an excellent job of describing the mechanics of the program. My name is Don Mazziotti, for the record. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Beaverton, Oregon. And I have a slightly different perspective on this legislation than perhaps others have. My job is to not only provide or to attempt to provide low-income housing, safe neighborhoods and improved environment in our community, provide housing inspections and planning. But my job is also to try to promote jobs. And frankly, the most difficult task that I have, my greatest problem, is attracting private investment to low-income areas in our community. Virtually every community that I've visited in Oregon, with very few exceptions, has areas similar to Beaverton that are two or three census districts that may have 4,000 or 5,000 people in them who are low income or who are underemployed or completely unemployed. And within those areas, there are the possibility for finding jobs for those people, but only if we are able to attract companies willing to make the investment necessary to bring folks on to do work. I could give you 5, 6, 7 examples of companies today in Beaverton who for the past 6 years have been seeking funding or financing for their businesses but have not been able to do so because of the current economic circumstance, which is well known to, I'm sure, most of you. I believe that the tax credit, which you are considering or have authored, would, with or without the federal tax credit, make a significant difference in our community and communities all over Oregon because it would attract investors who could also incidentally be community banks that would invest and loan into projects, would lower their risk of default. It would increase the prospect of them being able to finance businesses. And beyond that, it would provide capital for projects that otherwise have gone starving for capital since 2005. This bill, the basic purpose of which is to leverage a modest amount of state funding, none for the first 2 years, to spur significant job creation and rehabilitation in underserved communities. I'm here to tell you first that I think it's fantastic that you have put this bill forward. I think it's a job creation bill, that it will go to work immediately, and that I can provide you with examples of companies who can utilize this funding today and put people to work tomorrow. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chair. My name is Stephen Brooks. I'm a former New Market Tax Credit Compliance and Development Officer for a private company in Portland. I'm currently working as a consultant for the City of Beaverton on development finance projects, so I'm like Don's answer to, well, how do we actually do this? New Markets is one of the tools that I'm familiar with, and I'm here primarily to back what Don says, and that I think this is a tremendous tool for communities to help create developments and create jobs. But I think in particular I wanted to focus on a specific aspect of this bill that I think makes it particularly valuable for smaller communities like Beaverton.
Okay, and we're very time challenged.
This will take me 30 seconds.
Okay.
The state bill allows for credits to be issued in exchange for a long-term debt investment. What this really means is that small investors can make a loan into a project that is then used to, or they make the loan into the credit entity that then makes a loan into a project, which increases the number of investors that could potentially take advantage of the credit, but at the same time can significantly reduce the complexity of these kinds of investments. One of the problems that people keep talking about the federal credit being, it's so complex and so expensive that it really is only feasible for large projects. This one little change in the state bill makes it available at a much smaller investment level, so that small banks, small local investors can put money into small businesses and small projects, and it becomes a much more flexible job growth tool in smaller communities like Beaverton. And it doesn't focus just on the large $20 million real estate development deals. So,
thank you. Question from the panel. Thank you very much. Sorry to rush you here.
It's okay.
Thank you.
We have two more witnesses, Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I don't know if you guys have tried to read this bill.
It has words like qualified community development entity has the meaning given that term in Section 45D of the Internal Revenue Code, providing that the entity has entered into or is controlled by an entity, blah, blah, blah. And I was in Seattle, and I spent about an hour and a half reading and trying to understand and marking up the bill. And when I was done, I rewarded myself by going to get the newspaper that was under the hotel door. And in the business section, I opened it up, and there's a story. And by my goodness, it's a story about the very bill I've been reading. And it says, tax credit bonanza, $27.3 million, the amount of tax credits used to build the nines in Portland. And that was one of the new market tax credit projects that has been funded with federal funds. When I think of that hotel, I haven't stayed in the hotel, but I've certainly been at events in the atrium dining area. I don't think it would be better if it had $3 million worth of state investment in it. This is the fourth iteration of this bill to come before our legislature. It has changed. Last time around, it was $10 million per project. Now it's $3 million per project cap. Now the words new market tax credits are never mentioned in the bill, and the bill has the title Oregon Low Income Community Jobs Initiative. However, there is no requirement in the bill or in federal law, that federal law that the bill follows, that investments stimulate any new job creation. That isn't a requirement. There's a requirement for reporting of jobs sustained or created, but there's no requirement that any jobs be created. Further, the definition of low-income community is quite generous. In fact, it includes much of our state. In our examination, we have found that after the important transient construction jobs that usually do seem to be tied to Oregon's investments, Oregon New Market Tax Credits have mostly been used for building buildings or remodeling buildings. The majority of jobs after that are relocated jobs. Jobs that were once in one building have now moved to a different building. The 1220 building, the one with the windmills on top of it, is a good example. ZGF had a staff on one side of downtown Portland, and it moved its staff to the other side of downtown Portland. That didn't generate jobs. The parking lot used to be a surface parking lot. Now it's a five-level parking lot. I assume there's somebody at a booth of that parking lot. That would be another job generated. And there's a concierge at the desk for the 11, I can't remember how many floors, 17 floors of apartments. So that would be a new job. But other than that, there aren't new jobs in the building. And there have been a lot of new market tax credit dollars come to our state. In fact, we only nine states in the capital have more per capita new market tax credits than Oregon. We're actually one of the leaders in the nation for getting these. I think it's because we have developers and CDEs that understand how they work, and so they've been getting the money to come here without the state putting in anything else. Of the 73 new market tax credit projects that we have that are currently on a website, a federal website, they were all built without any $3 million investment by the state. One of our problems, then, with this bill is the absence of a problem to be solved. Oregon already receives more per capita than in federal dollars than most states. If you look at the first piece of your handout, you see how we lead the western states quite significantly. Further, following federal law, the investments must be in a census district that is a low income according to interpretation of census data. But in fact, as this article points out, universities are going to have low-income census districts, and yet sometimes they're very tony parts of town. Think of Reed as one of those areas.
Jody, can you wrap? We have your testimony. Can you wrap up so that we can? I just found out I'm losing almost all my committee in like 5 minutes.
Do you want to just hold it over?
No.
Okay. I will be sending you the testimony. It's gotten messed with during the day today. But I want to use the one example that they handed to you was the Vanport Project in Portland on Newmark, on Martin Luther King, where they loaned in, I believe, $3 million, and the transaction costs for that are someplace between $330,000 and $460,000 on a $3 million federal tax credit. That's why Advantage Capital is here, because the profit for the people who manage this is extremely high. That's why they go from state to state. They're pushing it in 7 states this year, trying to get more states to buy in so that they can make more profit, and that's the advantage that they're here about. And I will submit, there's some really wonky parts of my testimony that I never planned on saying to you today.
Thanks, Jody, and thanks for your understanding. Marcia?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. I've done some looking at some of the projects in different states, and so I'm highlighting 2 or 3 of them. The Good Project, a community counseling center, $5 million, $2.5 million in new market tax financing, consolidates 104 employees in one location, may add 30 new staff, replaces an old facility. This is the new facility. If we had 30 new employees and they were all social workers in Illinois, their salary would be $56,000. Illinois has now a 5% sales tax. That would be $2,800 if they had no deductions at all. The state new market tax credit is just shy of $1 million. Recouping the state investment for those 30 jobs, if they come to be, is about 12 years. The bad, 2 bads. Allen Brothers Steaks, refinancing real estate and equipment so there were no construction jobs, saved some jobs, but they didn't say how many. A $2.7 million Illinois investment. Meat cutters average $26,200 a year. Take 21 years to recoup out of those meat cutter salaries. The company was founded in 1893, but maybe it was one of those companies where the banks didn't want to take a chance on them. Rutgers Candy, an employee buyout, again, no construction. Candy Distribution Center, someplace between 120 and 180 jobs. Assume all forklift jobs, $24,000 a year wages. Illinois investment, $2.9 million. Again, over 20 years to recoup that. The Ugly, Producer's Choice Soy Energy, LLC, in Moberly, Missouri. The city abated 10 years of property tax. The city issued $16 million in bonds to improve roads, traffic signals, and stormwater facilities. Producer's Choice will pay back with tax savings. Plant is constructed for about $17 million. They have 300 local investors, $9.7 million in Missouri new market tax credits. The plant was constructed. This is a picture of their open house. The plant meets with Missouri standards to produce biodiesel. The investors attend the grand opening last year in June. The subcontractors are suing the contractor. The plant was to be producing 5 million gallons of biodiesel per year. And as of May 16th, 2011, the Moberly Monitor, their newspaper, responded to my email request and said, as far as they know, not 1 gallon of biodiesel has been produced in the plant, and this is a year after the grand opening. And the Really Ugly, this is not a state new market tax credit. The 4 prior were. The LeMay America's Car Museum.
Marcia, if it's not a new market tax credit.
It is a new market tax credit. It just doesn't have a state new market tax credit.
Okay, we really don't have time to see it. We're talking about the state one.
Okay, the other 3 were all states. Okay. There is one thing that I want to point out in this, and I do have an example of what happens with new market tax credits. And this is an example from a Vermont project. The new market transaction costs a 15th of the total project cost.
And is that state or federal?
that's actually federal, but that was a good, I thought it was a good example to show you all of the little ways that the project financing comes together.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Okay, thank you for your patience, committee. And thank you. Sorry to rush you. Sorry to rush everybody, actually. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 817, and we are adjourned. Adjourned. And we are